Good morning, University of Manitoba campus, and welcome to UMFM's Information and Entertainment Program, Your Campus Today for Wednesday, October the 3rd. I'm going to be your host, David Tufain. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11:30 a.m., we bring you all the U of M news that's fit for your ears, plus keep you in the loop on just a few of the great events going on here at the U of M campus that you need to know about. On today's show, the U of M considers butting out completely. UMSU launches its new peer tutoring program, and we speak with J.D. Ormond from J.D. and the Sunshine Band about the band's fundraising show this weekend. All this and more coming up next right here on Your Campus Today. The U of M Fort Garry campus is going completely smoke-free. The announcement comes after a September 13th report from a Canadian Cancer Society where it showed that there are 65 100% smoke-free campuses in Canada. That number is up from 30 campuses in 2017 and 4 in 2007. The report shows a growing number of Canadian campuses are banning smoking completely, both indoors and outdoors, and encourages more universities to follow suit. Any smoking restrictions would reportedly not include Investors Group Field events. U of M Fort Garry campus policy does not allow smoking of any kind either indoors or within 8 meters of any buildings, but otherwise students are free to smoke on campus grounds. The U of M's Bannatyne campus has been completely smoke-free since 2006. The University of Winnipeg implemented a smoke-free policy in 2008, which was updated in 2015 to include vaping and e-cigarettes. U of M spokesperson John Danakis said a ban is not necessarily being considered. Rather, the university, following the language used by the Canadian Cancer Society, is considering ways of creating a smoke-free campus. Danakis said the conversation is still in the early stages and would not give specifics about what the transition would look like. While there is no timeline in place, Danakis said the conversation will include all relevant groups on campus, and with the appropriate support, something could happen next year or in the next few years. Other universities have opted to create a designated smoking area of banning smoking outright. The Fort Garry campus spans nearly 3 square kilometers. If a student has back-to-back classes, they may only have 10 to 15 minutes to travel from one class to the next. That may not be enough time for a cigarette if they have to leave campus to do so. Erin Miner, a student and smoker, said while she did not support a campus-wide ban, designated smoking areas would benefit students. I would say I'm against a ban, Miner said, just because I know several smokers, especially considering that I'm in the fine arts department. There are many smokers among us here. I believe if there were regulated smoking areas, it would be better than banning it across the entire campus. Structures of Indifference, published by the University of Manitoba Press, looks at the life and death of Brian Sinclair in the context of colonialism. Sinclair, 45, was sent to the Health Sciences Center by community healthcare staffer for a catheter change. Sinclair was found dead in his wheelchair 34 hours later, untreated by emergency room staff. The book stems from the work of the Brian Sinclair Working Group that was formed to examine racism as a factor in Sinclair's death. It established a cross-discipline approach to research, analyze, and address discrimination in the healthcare system. In 2014, they hosted a public forum in which health researchers discussed how discriminatory assumptions have direct effects on the range of decisions in healthcare, including treatment decisions. Mary Jane McCallum, U of M Department of History professor, has been working with the group since 2014 and wrote the book with her co-author Adele Perry over the course of approximately the past year. McCallum said the goal of the book was to make racism and indifference in the healthcare system visible. There were several ways that Brian Sinclair was misrecognized in life and death, and these and other misrecognitions go on all the time for many other people who face anti-Indigenous racism, she said. For Sinclair, he was misrecognized as drunk and as homeless, and these misrecognitions led directly to the failure to provide treatment. Jarvis Brownlee, a U of M history professor, was unsurprised by Sinclair's death. He says that Canada has a terrible record of treating Indigenous people in the healthcare system. Indigenous people have always had less access to healthcare than your average Canadian citizen, and this remains true, whether they live in Winnipeg or a fly-in reserve, he said. McCallum said that the other accounts taken during the inquest portrayed Sinclair as having an equal part in his own death, as it appeared that he frequented hospitals too much. It is the portrayal of Indigenous people as already sick and dying that frees those responsible of culpability, she said. It also reassures settlers of the rightfulness of their dominance. Brownlee said this portrayal is not new. I could find you multiple quotations from Indian Affairs records discussing the various reasons why Indigenous people did not deserve equal health care, such as claims that they bothered doctors for trivial ailments, and they were responsible for their own injuries, and therefore basically should expect to suffer, and that they were best left with their Indian dope, quote-unquote, to cure themselves, he said. McCallum said racism has not considered to be a factor in Sinclair's death, and that the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority claimed that the issue was in the way of the hospital process and its patients, not in the treatment given to Sinclair. During her time with the working group, it created exercises to situate participants in Sinclair's final hours. In the exercises, participants were asked to set an alarm for 34 hours in the future to reflect on the time that Sinclair spent in the HSC emergency room. It is an imperfect exercise because during this time, Brian was, of course, in a lot of pain, especially as the infection spread through his body and he was dying, she said. McCallum said she researched and wrote the book, and she felt she could bring her skills in historical research to shed light into the subject. It is important to see that Sinclair's story is not a rarity. Structures of Indifference can be bought at Amazon.ca and UofMPress.ca. The UMSU executive is making good on its promise to introduce a peer-to-peer tutoring platform for students. The idea was introduced by the Elevate UMSU slate, which went on to sweep the executive ballot during the 2018 UMSU general elections. The project, which will connect students with student tutors through an online app, began to take shape in the summer. In August, UMSU President Jacob Sanderson said there were already more than 100 tutor applicants for the program. At the September 13th UMSU Board of Directors meeting, it was announced UMSU hired a part-time staffer to handle the influx of applications and vet potential tutors. It was also noted that UMSU hoped to have a base of tutors ready for mid to late September and would advertise the program possible tutees at this time. UMSU VP Student Services Carly Mastromonaco said that the app will be a chance for students to get help from peers with specific classes. This program offers students the opportunity to connect with peers and be tutored on a one-to-one basis in course-specific topics. Carly said, the university offers a student-centric tutoring program through the Academic Learning Center. Located in the Tier Building, the center offers peer writing tutors, peer study skill coaches, online tutoring, writing workshops, and more. The ALC also provides resources for English as an additional language students, including an ELA instructor who, along with assistance with assignments, provides support with communication skills and improving students' grasp on the English language. According to the August 30th UMSU Board of Governors meeting agenda, peer tutors hired through the UMSU program may earn up to $15 an hour when approved. Tutors can request a maximum of $15 an hour for their services, which will then be paid by the student through the app. The ALC writing tutor position and the ALC content study skills tutor position both remunerate $17 an hour. Outside of fees included in base tuition costs, the ALC tutoring service is free to students. Mastromonaco said that the UMSU peer tutoring service can be considered a different service from the ALC because of its course-specific options. While providing some course-specific tutoring options to students, the ALC focuses heavily on general academic writing and studying skills, Mastromonaco explained. This program provides heightened accessibility to course-specific tutors. The program helps to facilitate the efficacy of connecting a tutee to a tutor and will hopefully address the overwhelming volume of students looking for course-specific help here on campus. The ALC is not the only tutoring resource available to U of M students. Many faculties have their own separate systems, including a tutor registry set up by the Faculty of Engineering and help centers for math, physics, and computer science. The UMSU tutoring program will operate through the Nimbus tutoring mobile app, which will, according to a Facebook post published by UMSU, allow students to match with interested tutees, set up meetings and communication, and control payment in-app. Tutors will also have the opportunity to receive a letter of reference for their services. Up next, Your Campus Today correspondent Michael Elves speak with J.D. Ormond and the Sunshine Hoedown, taking place this Saturday at the Goodwill Social Club. It's a fundraiser for the band's upcoming tour to B.C.
All right, well, J.D. Ormond is the titular J.D. in J.D. and the Sunshine Band. They're gearing up for a tour, and they're holding a fundraiser this Saturday, October 6th at the Goodwill. J.D. joins me by phone. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, yeah. Just getting over a bit of a cold, I guess. I lost my voice on the weekend.
That's the fall. This is how it goes. So obviously the fundraiser's happening Saturday. Do you hit the road right after that, or is this kind of like in anticipation of a tour?
Yeah, we don't hit the road until the 25th of October.
And as I understand it, you're going to play a festival on Vancouver Island?
Yeah, it's called the Woodstove Festival. And it's like, yeah, right on Vancouver Island. And none of us have been out there before, so it's quite the trip. Trippy.
Now, when it comes to kind of getting the Sunshine Band, like I know you guys have played Interstellar Rodeo and some like kind of other like closer things. Logistics-wise for something like this, how much of a like exponential difference is it to, you know, getting out of town by like an hour or something like that?
Yeah, it's it's like kind of like night and day.
Yeah,
so not the same thing at all. I mean, for local shows, we generally kind of like rally. We give ourselves a fair amount of time before the shows to kind of like meet up and chill out, you know. But this, where, you know, we're going to be just driving and spending all day together, and, you know, sleeping in the same quarters, and it's a way different thing. So we've only done one kind of like out of town tour before. It was to Yorkton, and it was a success. I was like, you know, well, I was not sure because I'm, you know, unfamiliar with some folks' kind of like lifestyle habits and their, you know, how they live their lives. But it went quite well. Everybody had a good time, got along. And but this will be like 14 times that. 14 Yorktons.
14 Yorktons, yeah. Now, in terms of the numbers, because the Sunshine Band can kind of be like an amorphous thing, how many people are going on the tour?
So at this point, there's going to be 9 of us, how it's looking thus far. So we're going to take the Sunshine Van, which is like a 15-passenger, you know, one of those big white E-Series or whatever they are, the Mennonite vans. And we're loading as much stuff as we possibly can into it. Yeah, and hitting the road. So there's 9 of us. So the space is going to be, it's going to be tight, for sure.
So how did you end up on this the festival bill? Like, did you specifically apply for this festival, or were you approached by the organizer?
No, yeah, it was a friend of mine who I planted trees with. He was in town a few years ago, and I gave him like a stack of our CDs because he is interested in what we do, and I guess he's just been giving them out to people as he kind of travels and moves through the country and stuff. And I guess, yeah, he must have just given our CD to somebody out there on Vancouver Island, perhaps. Maybe he was planting, I don't know. And they just reached out to us and, you know, asked us if we wanted to come. And I thought about it I gave it a fair amount of time to think about it. Like, and then I just kind of like realized that it might be the, you know, it's one of the only opportunities we get to do something like this, perhaps ever. So I kind of like trumped my, you know, I guess like apprehensions about doing it. And it was like, well, just go for it and see what happens. And, you know, there'll be a story or many stories that come out of it, regardless of how the thing ends up going. Like, and it will be a good memory for everybody involved, or at least a memory.
Yeah. And there could be some,
those are important.
Some songs that come out of those stories too.
Yes. So one of the things we're thinking about doing is, well, first of all, we're doing 6 shows along the way, and 5 of those are at kind of like nonprofit or community organizations. That's how we kind of like wanted to line it up. Clubs are actually, they're harder to get, they're harder to book.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of somewhat short notice. So we just reached out to community organizations and basically like, hey, we'll come to your spot and play for you guys, and, you know, let's have a little get down at your place. And people have been very responsive to that, and I think like that just kind of like, I guess that taps in a bit to what the Sunshine Band is and does and wants to continue to do, is just kind of meet people where they're at.
Right, these are places that wouldn't necessarily be venues, but you know, where this kind of music might be inspiration for a similar kind of endeavor.
Yeah, there's certainly that. I mean, the people are there. It's just the, you know, the entertainment is often not there. You know, folks hang out a lot at Siloam Mission and at the various like drop-ins around town, and you know, there's it's rare that there's, I guess, entertainment or music or things for people to do. So I think that, yeah, they were pretty responsive to what our plan was. So that's pretty good. And it's kind of gives us a boost of kind of confidence that we're, going into kind of like good environments, friendly environments. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty sweet. And along the way, we're going to be chatting with people and recording sort of like sound bites and little stories and jokes along the way, and kind of telling a story and getting people to give kind of shout outs. And the plan is to take all of those things and to use it as kind of like lyrical concept for our new album that we're going to make.
So for folks who don't necessarily know the genesis of why it's called the Sunshine Band and things, can you kind of explain a little bit about Sunshine House?
Yeah, so Sunshine House is a drop-in resource center on Logan and Sherbrooke that has a, I guess, a harm reduction principle in which people can come as they are and, I guess, participate in sort of skills building and social inclusion activities. And, you know, yeah, so I, a number of years ago, was coordinated a project for solvent users who, yeah, the intention of that program was to just reintroduce some motor skills and I guess recreational activities in the lives of people who are living on the streets who are using or have used solvents in the past. And so that's one of the programs that exist here. You know, basically we're trying to reach at-risk or marginalized individuals and create structures that accommodate their lifestyles and their lives that don't alienate them and, you know, encourage, health promotion and skills building. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of what goes on here. Yeah.
And out of a program for motor skills, you're now two albums in and a third on the way, then it sounds like?
Yeah. So it's 5 years on. We've been a band for 5 years now. It's quite amazing. Like it basically stemmed from one of the modules that we did for the Solvent Users Recreation Project was music. Prior to that, we had done, you know, just a wide array of, you know, recreational things that hopefully we wanted to, you know, attract as diverse a community as we could and tap into people's interests. And the last one we did was music. And for that, I brought in a few buddies and we kind of unearthed some stories that we had, I guess, people had been sharing all along, and getting to know people over the 9 month period. There was a lot of stories and jokes and, you know, just people getting to know one another. And so we kind of, people weren't exactly like professional musicians in the group, but they contributed with through their stories. So we spun them up into a song. And from that, and we made a video, music video, and we recorded the tune. And then when the project wrapped up, we kind of looked back at what some successes were and things we might be able to continue on. And we decided just to do, we decided to focus exclusively on music. So when Sunshine House reopened their doors a few months later, after the project ended, the same folks were interested in coming back and focusing on music. So we kind of like rehearsed and recorded and wrote music with the group and put out an album. And then it's just been kind of rolling from there. So it just hasn't stopped, you know, and it's great.
Absolutely. So the event this Saturday at the Goodwill also features the Like That Drag Bunch, yep. And everything starts at 9 p.m. Yep. Tickets, as far as I understand, $10 through eventbrite.ca. Can you get them anywhere else right now?
No, but you can get them at the door.
At the door.
I'm assuming that folks are going to get them at the door.
Walk Up Winnipeg, that's where most of them will go. That's true.
Yeah, in hindsight, I think I should have printed tickets and then just gone and forced people to buy them. That's the way to go.
But especially for a fundraiser.
Especially for a fundraiser, because people are willing to contribute and not come, you know, which is fine by us, because we need to raise money to go on this trip. So yeah, it's going to be a good night of music, and my voice will probably be somewhat repaired by then. And if not, then I'm going to sound like Bryan Adams for people.
All right, then you can do a really good cover of Summer '69. maybe I'll get you to pick a track off of one of the actual Sunshine Band albums, though, before we go here, JD.
Let's do how about Saturday Night? It's our hit.
That's the one. That's got a video and everything, so.
Yeah, it's got a vid. It's your candy.
And it works since this event goes down Saturday night. JD, best of luck with the fundraiser, and thanks for taking some time to talk about it.
Thanks so much, Michael.
I've got a girl who is crazy about me, and I cannot blame her for that. But when she said she'd go crazy without me, I try to break from her grasp on a Saturday night. I head up the street to meet my old buddy. His name's Jim, but we call him Jack. We have a few sips from his flask of Bacardi and head out over the track. Main Street to see what is happening. Some good, some bad, half and half. No matter what kind of joke someone's cracking, somebody somewhere will laugh. And that's what I like. I don't mind Tuesday, it's fine for a blue jay. Thursday morning's just where it should. Time's all right, 'cause it's noontime, but Saturday night is when I go walking, head up the street, hear who is talking, stop at the bar to see if it's rocking, but if it don't rock, I say, who's got a light?
Children and teens who experience mental health illnesses are at an increased risk for adverse mental health and social outcomes as adults, a study by the Manitoba Center for Health Policy at the University of Manitoba showed. Being diagnosed with a mental illness before the age of 18, the study found, increases the likelihood of adverse experiences in adulthood, including suicidal behavior, not graduating from high school, requiring income assistance, and being involved with the justice system. Other childhood factors such as income and family structure explain some of the association between childhood mental illness and adult difficulties, but the risk remained strong even after adjusting for those factors, said the study's lead author, Dr. Mariette Chartres, assistant professor of community health sciences at the Max Rady College of Medicine in the Rady Faculty of Health Sciences. Our findings indicate that the childhood mental illness puts kids at significant risk for ongoing challenges later in life. When a child has an illness such as anxiety, depression, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, it is likely to cloud their adult life. This strongly highlights the need for mental illness prevention and improved mental health services for this age group. The MCHP conducted the study Mental Illness Among Adult Manitobans for Manitoba Health to assist it in developing Manitoba's mental health and addiction strategy. Chartres' team used the Manitoba Population Research Data Repository, which is housed at the MCHP, and allowed researchers to trace individuals' interactions with the health, social service, education, and justice systems without the individuals being personally identified. The researchers focused on more than 60,000 Manitobans born between 1980 to 1981 and 1984 to 1985. They analyzed the de-identified data about these children as they grew into their 30s. More than 16% of individuals in this cohort were diagnosed with a mental disorder during their childhood or teen years. Two-thirds of individuals diagnosed as children were still living with the same condition as adults. Manitobans who were hospitalized for attempted suicide before the age of 18 were 3 times more likely to die by suicide and 6 times more likely to be re-hospitalized for attempted suicide in adulthood. The study took a snapshot of adult mental illness in Manitoba from 2010 to 2011 to 2014 to 2015, using a database of virtually all Manitobans. In this 5-year period, about 28% of adults were diagnosed with at least one of the mental illnesses examined in the study. The most prevalent illnesses were mood and anxiety disorders, a category that includes depression, diagnosed in 23% of adults, and substance use disorders, diagnosed in 6% of adults. The prevalence of mental illness has remained stable since MCHP's last 5-year report in 2004. The suicide rate is also unchanged since the 2004 report. The actual prevalence of mental disorders is undoubtedly higher, Chartres said. The figure of 28% only represents adults who were diagnosed by doctors or nurse practitioners. We don't have data for people who seek help from professionals such as psychologists and social workers. We also know that many people with mental disorders never seek treatment. In both rural and urban regions, the prevalence of mental illness increased as average neighborhood income decreased. The same was true for the rate of suicide attempts. Compared to the general population, a higher rate of mental illness was found among adults living in personal care homes, those receiving income assistance, those living in social housing, and those involved in the justice system, either as accused or as victims. The study wasn't able to say which came first, the illness or the life circumstances, only that there is an association between these groups and mental illnesses. Rates of suicide and attempted suicide were also higher in all of these groups. The study's recommendations included: increase the mental health promotion, mental health prevention, and suicide prevention efforts, strengthen mental health services and improve access to them, develop the mental health skills and knowledge for the workforce, in healthcare and beyond, address health inequities, support mental health research, coordinate services among government departments, including health, social services, education, and justice. The full report is available online, umanitoba.ca/faculties/health_sciences/medicine. Michael Kaler is a builder. When he was younger, he and his dad constructed model planes and flew them. He's put together a 3D printer in a case that he can connect to with a smartphone. And in grade 11, he built a racing drone that can go 110 kilometers per hour. He controls the drone with virtual reality goggles. "I impressed myself for doing that one," he said proudly. A graduate of Calvin Christian School, Kaler is one of 2 first-year University of Manitoba students who are among the 2018 Schulich leaders. He received a $100,000 entrance scholarship from the Schulich Foundation and is entering the Department of Mechanical Engineering with the goal of specializing in aerospace technology. Which is good, because he hopes to land a job in that field someday. His dream job is to work for NASA in some capacity. "I'd love to have a job like that," he said. Kaler is almost embarrassed he was selected as a Schulich leader. "There were a lot of very worthy candidates," he explains. "I have no idea why they picked me, but I am very appreciative that I was selected." His selection certainly has something to do with his academic record. He was always good in math and excelled in physics and sciences. He is motivated by why, which makes him a privilege to teach, an example to his peers, said Lyle Morris, Kaler's grade 12 physics and pre-calc teacher. Another factor in selecting Schulich leaders is their community service, and Kaler's volunteerism speaks for itself. Even though, by his own admission, he is not a social person, he has a great passion for helping others. He has been teaching English as a second language with refugees and newcomers to Canada, and he recently traveled to Mexico with a school group to build 2 houses for economically challenged families. "It was an amazing experience," he notes. "The families were very appreciative of us being there, because they were in a situation where they couldn't control living in a plot of sand of only about 300 square feet. We were able to connect well, despite the differences in language," he added. "It made me feel like I was doing something useful." Kaler's aspirations, however, are decidedly more skyward. "I want to build something no one has built before," he said. "I can see myself pursuing an advanced aerospace education after my master's degree, and then coming back to Manitoba to work for companies like Boeing or Magellan. And then, who knows? I follow SpaceX," he said wistfully. Schulich leadership scholarships are prestigious entrance scholarships awarded to 50 high school graduates enrolling in a science, technology, engineering, or mathematics undergraduate program at 20 partner universities in Canada. Each year, every high school in Canada can submit one Schulich Leader nominee based on an academic excellence in STEM, entrepreneurial leadership, and financial need. Recognizing the increasing importance of the impact that STEM disciplines will have on the prosperity of future generations, businessman and philanthropist Seymour Schulich established this $100 million scholarship fund in 2012 to encourage our best and brightest students to become the next pioneers of global scientific research and innovation. That's going to do it for us here this week on Your Campus Day. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm very sick today, but I'm going to be back on Friday. And we have a wonderful social on Friday that ASBC is putting on. It is the First Affair. You can get your tickets for free on PostEd. I hope to see you all there, and I hope to feel a lot better on Friday. We're going to have our show again, obviously, 11:30 a.m. to wrap up the week. I've been me, you've been you, and this has been Your Campus Today. Your Campus Today is a collaborative production between UM Today, the Manitoban, the Department of Student Life, and this station, UMFM 101.5. Thanks for listening, folks. If you have a story you'd like us to feature or want to send in feedback, please email us at campustoday@umfm.com.